This podcast is sponsored by Legends of Kalaesia, a totally awesome turn-based strategy game that happened to have been made in my studio. It's a fast-paced multiplayer game for PC, Mac, iOS, and Android, and has a free demo available right now on Steam, iTunes, and Google Play. Hi there, I'm Chris Natsuume. The internet knows me as Nine Squirrels. This is the People Make Things podcast, where we talk about the lives, the struggles, and the real-life stories of the people behind the scenes and in the trenches making your entertainment. We're doing something a little different on the show today. I am actually live streaming the creation of this podcast live on Twitch, and that's the subject of the show today, is talking about dealing with social media when releasing information about a new product. I'm going to talk a lot about that. Then we're going to have an interview with Edward Lee. He's a game developer from Hong Kong, runs a company called Twitchy Finger. This is a great show today. It is episode 16. All right, welcome to the show. We are going to talk about some neat stuff today. For those of you who don't know, I'm a game developer, and I develop all kinds of games. I do puzzle games and casual games and match three games and hidden object games. I've done all kinds of stuff. Most recently, I have been building strategy games. We did a strategy game called Legends of Kalaesia. It did relatively well. We released that about this time last year. And since then, we've been working on that game. But quietly, we've also been working on our next strategy game. And this is kind of our response to a lot of criticisms that we got about our first casual game, our first strategy game. A bunch of thoughts that, people were like, hey, this game is really great, but have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about doing that? I'm not going to get into the details. There's all kinds of stuff out there. If you want, you can go find all the details. But the game is called Last Regiment, and it's our new thing. It's the new thing that I'm going to be promoting and working on, and I've sort of released it and told everyone I'm doing this thing. And that experience that I went through today of saying, hey, I'm going to do this new thing, and expressing that to the world and opening that up to the world, that was a really interesting experience for me. And I thought that that would make a really great topic for the podcast today, because it's something that everyone who does some kind of entertainment experiences. And for people who haven't, tried to, make something like a book or write a song or, put a band together or start a podcast or any of that sort of thing, you may not know this, but for all of the people who've ever done one of those things, there's this little part deep inside of you that wonders, maybe I should just keep this really quiet. Maybe I shouldn't tell anyone about the thing that I'm doing, and I should keep that silent because that gives me the freedom to quit doing it and nobody gives me any shit about it. There's always that feeling of like, you tell somebody, hey, I'm gonna write a novel, and then 2 months later you go to a party and they're like, hey man, how's that novel coming? And there's that little, and they may not even mean it. They may genuinely are just making conversation, but they may, in you, there's this feeling of like, I haven't done anything and I'm ashamed and this guy's making fun of me and fuck you. There's that. And so there's always this feeling that maybe I should just keep quiet about what I'm building until I'm done. And then I can just like release it to the world. Look at this thing I made. It's so amazing. Wow. And then they'll know, right? And there's always that inclination to do that. But the problem is, you don't make good entertainment like that. You certainly don't work well in teams like that. That's not the way you make entertainment. And so you have to get to this point where you say to yourself, I'm going to tell the world that I'm building something, and I'm going to tell them what I'm building, and I'm going to show them this thing that's not done yet. It's very early. It's ugly. It's not what I want it to be yet. But I'd like some opinions on it. I'd like people to see it. I'd like people to start caring about it. I'd like people to start contributing ideas for it. And especially in the modern world where everything is about social media and everything is about this interconnectivity of, people twittering and tweeting, twittering. I don't even know whatever the kids say these days. I mean, everything, you got to have stuff on your, you got to have stuff on Twitter. You got to have stuff on Facebook. You got to have stuff on Instagram. You know, you got to go to Reddit and you have to do here's my feedback Friday or my work in progress Wednesday or my screenshot Saturday or tell me that I suck Tuesday or whatever the fuck you've got. You know, you've got to have all of this stuff. And so I decided that it was time. It was time for us to announce Last Regiment, let the world know that we're building it, show them an early build, and I did it on stream in Twitch. And, you know, I was so... It's hard to... You know, it's such a silly thing because for most of the world, this doesn't matter. For everyone but the people working on this game, nobody gives a shit, right? It's just... There's so much shit, and nobody cares. But I care because this is my thing, and this is my baby, and this is what I'm building. And so I think to myself, I'm going to make a big deal out of it, you know, and I set up a really nice, you know, in XSplit, I set up a really great sort of thing, you know, with, you know, pictures and, you know, I had all set up and all ready to go. And we, you know, we've been posting about it for weeks on all the social media and, hey, check it out in Facebook and, hey, check it out here, check it out there. And, you know, I think some people are actually going to show up and it comes time for it to start. And I start up XSplit and, blah, fuck, of course. It doesn't work, right? For whatever reason, our game uses OpenGL, and OpenGL is not picked up by XSplit in some odd cases on opposite Wednesdays, and, you know, everything works except for I can't show the game in the live stream. And, you know, and suddenly all these people show up, and these are people that supported us for our last game, and I'm all excited, and they're all like, hey, man, when's the thing starting? And I'm trying to, I'm like, I could go into it, but it... We finally got it to work. I had to, like, at the very last minute, switch everything over to OBS, and I had a really kind of crappy, gimpy, you know, my first stream-looking Twitch that we put up, but nobody cared. The people who showed up looked at our game, and it was great, and it was fun. But this thing that we did is... It's something that didn't used to exist in the world of making creative entertainment. It's something new in the world that now everyone who's doing creative entertainment has to deal with. This when do you expose yourself to the internet? And I thought it was a really fascinating moment when I was done. I thought, you know, everyone goes through this. Everyone who makes a game goes through this. Everyone who writes a song goes through this. You know, all the digital comics and all of the comedians and everybody, they face that moment where they tell the world, I'm going to do this thing and I'm serious about it and I'm going to hope that people listen to it. That thing is a moment that used to not really exist. You know, it used to be the moment that it existed was the time that maybe you told your friends at the bar or something, but you didn't tell the internet at large. You didn't create a Facebook record and a Google streaming, you know, backlog of, you know, look at my dev blogs and look at all my whatever, you know, but this is what you have to do to get anyone to know that you're doing anything anymore. And so, This first round of marketing, this telling the world that you exist and then walking them through what you're doing, this is a brand new thing that exists in the worlds of social media and internet. And it's fascinating. It's an absolutely fascinating thing. So that happened. And I wanted to talk about some of the challenges that I had for it. One of the challenges I had was like, when do we do this? When is the appropriate time to show people? Because, like, you know, if you show it too late, you're going to get that thing where everyone's like, oh, man, you should totally have done this. Or you should totally have done that. And you're like, yeah, I totally agree. I totally should have done that. But I didn't do that because I didn't know to do that. And now we are way the hell down the process. And there's no way I'm doing that now because I have to rebuild everything. Or you do it too early and you show people stuff and everyone looks at it. And it looks like crap because you're showing it to them really early and it's not done yet. And people look at it and their one impression of what you've done is crap. And then later you're like, hey, come check out this thing. Now that it's done, it's really awesome. And they think to themselves, yeah, I saw that thing like a year ago and it was shit. So, yeah, I'm not gonna. Yeah. And then your chance is lost, right? Because, you never get a second chance at a first impression, as the cliche goes. And so, you know, or what happens if you show it really early and you're still in the process of figuring out what it is you're going to do? And you're like, I'm going to do this and this and this, and we're going to have this and this and this. And these are all, you all genuinely want to do these things. These are things that you genuinely have on your plate and you're going to do them because that's what you want to do. But as you go through the process of development, you find out, hey, that thing that I thought was going to be really cool is actually not that cool at all. And maybe I shouldn't do it. So, and then people are like, but you promised. You said you were going to have this. Why doesn't it have this? Oh, you liar. How you? I knew I shouldn't trust my developer. You're all promises. And you, oh, shit, you know. But if you don't tell anyone, if you don't talk about it, then you can cut it. Nobody gives you any shit about it, right? So there's that quandary of, and I don't have a good answer as to when is too early and when is too late. You just kind of have to pick a point and say, yeah, I guess this is it. And you got to hope that the people who are watching it are cool. And that's the problem is you have to hope that the people who are watching it are cool. That's the second big point is like the internet can really turn on you. I don't know, you know, for those people who don't like deal with the internet much. I mean, everyone deals with the internet. Everyone goes and consumes from the internet. But for people who produce for the internet, you know, people who make things that the internet has opinions about, it's a really hard place. It's a painful place to do business because people get butt hurt so fast. And I don't want to hate them for it. I want to be understanding because I get it. Millennials have been made all of these promises and they've been marketed to since they were like that big, you know, since they were fetuses. And they're just so used to bullshit that they just assume everything is bullshit. And they're so quick to call you out on bullshit. Oh, this is bullshit. Oh, look, I'm being cheated. Oh, look, I'm being lied to. They just want to tear you down. And they've had such a constant stream of amazing stuff in their lives. They've had the best television shows and the best movies and the best music and the best everything. You know, you say, oh, well, the best music was in the 60s. Well, they had the music from the 60s and they had the music from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And they don't listen to any of the shit music from the, like, they've had this curated nonstop stream of awesome content since they were born. And they think that everything has to be that awesome or they need to tear it down. And when you fail them, when you fail to consistently deliver awesome content exactly the way they want it, exactly how they like it, you're bad. There's a moral problem with that. And you get attacked. And the internet is ready to destroy you. It's ready to make you miserable. And here's the other point, the third point. They have tools to make you miserable that nobody ever had before. You know, it used to be you turned on a U2 song and you were like, man, that's a shit U2 song. I'm not going to listen to that. And that was pretty much the end of it. That was as far as your opinion went as a guy who was listening to U2. But now, you know, you can go on Amazon and you can write a big review about why they suck and you can go give them 0 stars. And you know, of course, for U2, it doesn't matter because they're U2. But for a small indie developer or a small indie band or somebody who does like a small web comic or something like that, when the hate starts to roll in, it snowballs and it gets really big. I have a really good friend who is doing a webcomic. I'm not going to use her name because I don't want to dox her or anything like that. But she recently had a couple comics do really well. They kind of got some small viral success and she was really excited. And the next thing that happened was she fell into the claws of the internet and some people on Twitter decided they didn't like her and they didn't like the message of one of her comics and they started stealing her comics and replacing some of the art or replacing some of the words and calling her terrible things and tweeting horrible stuff to her, and to the point where she just finally said, fuck it, I'm out, and she quit Twitter. She was just like, I'm not even going to be on Twitter anymore because this is not worth it. And you know, it's hard enough to be a young web comic and it's hard enough to to try to find your creative voice and to put something out there. And if you're going to talk about anything meaningful, to put something meaningful out there that actually, you know, relates to what you feel without having somebody out there who is not just saying, that's not for me, I don't like that, but is actually actively trying to tear you down and destroy you because, I don't know, because the internet, whatever. I don't know, because that's how the internet works. Sucks, but it's true. And that's one of the dangers of being online. And it's even worse than that. I mean, there was a friend of mine, not a good friend, but somebody I knew who was on Twitch. And she had, and again, I won't talk about too much detail because I don't want, you know, the people to get a hold of her. Not that anyone listens to this podcast, but she had a server set up for an online game, and she changed from one server to another, and a bunch of her Twitch users who would play with her on this online game on that server moved to the new server with her. And she moved servers because the old server had apparently become kind of racist or sexist or abusive or whatever. She decided it wasn't a nice place to be. And so she moved to a new server, and the person who was on who ran the old server got so upset and so butthurt about it that he swatted her, right? And for those who don't know what swatting is, it means calling the police in the States and giving them some story about how this person at this address is doing something so terrible that you need to go invade the house with a SWAT team. And she had like people come kick in her front door and come into her house with guns, you know, cops, real live cops with guns came and like, you know, searched her house and, you know, ran her kids through child welfare and whatnot, just because some guy didn't like that she was playing on the wrong server in a video game. That's real. That happened. That's not like I'm exaggerating. That's like a real fucked up story of a thing that happened. You know, I read another article. This isn't anybody I knew, but, you know, this is just I was on Reddit and I was looking through the Reddit Twitch forum, and there was somebody talking about they were just doing their normal thing. They were, you know, had some silly little live stream about a video game. And somebody came in and started using her real name as their username. And, oh, by the way, do you live at this address? And, oh, by the way, do you go to this school? And the next thing she knows, she starts getting phone calls at home. And the next thing she knows, she's getting phone calls at work. And the people who she works with are saying, hey, you really need to have your boyfriend stop calling us at work. And she's like, I don't have a boyfriend. It's just some strange fucker from the internet. Like, this happens. And sometimes when I'm putting together a marketing plan and I'm thinking about, you know, what have I got to do to market my game and market my podcast and all of this, there's a couple times where I just sit at the kitchen table with my wife and I say, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe is this worth this? Is it, you know, because I'm not anonymous. I mean, I can't be anonymous. I run a company. Google me. I'm there, right? I'm very, very easy to find on the internet. And unlike other people who do Twitches and whatnot, if somebody wants to dig me up, it's very trivially easy to find me, right? And I kind of live a little bit in fear of the day that I say something or do something that the internet decides they don't like. And suddenly, I don't know, the people call, you know, I live in a foreign country. Can they call up the government here and get me in trouble? I don't even know what can happen to me here. So, yeah, that's a thing I live in fear of. And sort of the last thing that I wanted to talk about this is sometimes you wonder if it's all actually worth it. Sometimes you think, you know, there's so much stuff that is being made. Why does my stuff need to get made too? And that's a real struggle that creative individuals have. You know, you think about the world right now, just in games alone. I mean, we'll just cut off everything else. We just talk about games. There is iOS, there is Google, there is Steam, there is PlayStation and Xbox and whatnot. And each one of those platforms has literally thousands of games. There's Game Boys and all of that other stuff. You know, if you look at the App Store just on the iPhone, there's like 1,000 games released every single week. And you're just one of those, right? If you look at and you go to Steam, you know, how many Steam games are released every week and how many of them are free? I mean, people go buy these humble bundles of games that have, you know, 100 games in it for $10. And you think, why does somebody need my extra game? Why does my one more game matter? And that's just games, right? If you're looking at the individual who's, you know, consuming entertainment product, you know, I've got X number of hours a day that I'm not working or sleeping or pooping or eating. You know, most people probably have 3 or 4 hours a day on average that they're not doing something that they have to do where they can just entertain themselves, right? And in that entertainment time, they've got games. Well, you know, they've also got TV, but they don't just have TV. They've got Netflix and they've got YouTube, you know, and there's how much content is there out on YouTube? You could eat those 3 hours a day easily on YouTube alone. They got Twitch and they could, you know, and the live stream, just one live stream is 3-4 hours. So, you know, how many hours are they eating away on live streams? And you know, if they don't want to watch something on a screen, they can go listen to music. And if they want to listen to music, it's not like they got to go buy a CD for $12 anymore. Now they can go to to Pandora and they can have, you know, I don't even know if anyone listens to Pandora anymore. There's Spotify or there's whatever. You've got some variety of like all you can consume music available to you for very, very little money. Or, you know, like my kids, you watch all your music right there on YouTube for free. I mean, there's like no limit to the amount of content that you can consume almost for free, if not free. And then you wonder, well, why is anyone going to consume my content? Why isn't what makes mine any better? And as a working artist, you have to like get over that hurdle and say, my content is also valuable. Maybe somebody wants this. And you have to get to that place. If you just live in the place where you think, I can't, my content is so, you know, and there is, it's a real struggle because you think, you know, how many episodes of Cheers are there? I'm less entertaining than the least entertaining episode of Cheers, and there's like 10 seasons of Cheers alone. Why are you even listening to this podcast? Go watch Cheers, right? And Cheers isn't even a particularly good sitcom anymore. I mean, you know, there's good new sitcoms. There's whatever you want. There's so much stuff out there. And as a working artist, you just have to say, I'm going to keep working at my thing, and I'm going to hope that there's some people out there for whom my thing speaks to them more than other things do, and maybe they're going to like it. And that's the place that you have to get to. And this week, I had a friend back in high school that used to play in a band with me, and he used to talk about getting up on stage as a band member and playing guitar or singing. He was always like, it's like standing up in front of a bunch of strangers in your underwear and just saying like, how do you feel about this? And I feel in many ways like I did that thing last week when I showed people my brand new unfinished game and explained, hey, this is what I'm building and this is what I want to make. And I hope that you want to come be part of this. And I hope that that's interesting for you. Now will you sign on to my 15 varieties of social media and blah, 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 blah. That's a new thing. And it's a thing that any working artist has got to deal with now. And hopefully you have people who care. And one of the things I'm grateful for is for this podcast and for my company and for my games, there's always been some people out there that care. There's going to be a few people that listen to this podcast. There are going to be a few people that come and watch the live streams of me doing dev blogs. There's going to be people who come to our Reddit site and read what I write about how we're building our game. And hopefully someday when we release the game, there'll be people who go out and buy that game and play that game with us. And I know that there's a few of those people. And my job as a working artist is to go out and find more of those people and to provide them with that content. So there, that's what I did last week. I hope that that's an interesting little view in on modern game development for those of you who don't do this. Or for those of you who do this and just wanted to hear that, yeah, somebody else deals with all this bullshit too. So that's all I'm going to talk about. I'm done with my time. We're going to have a little thing here where I try to convince you to give money to my charity. And when that is done, we are going to talk to my friend Edward Lee, who is a game developer in Hong Kong. He runs a company called Twitchy Finger. And this is actually one of the best interviews I've done for, hey, indie developer, here's a guy who's made a pretty solid indie success, and he's going to tell you how to do it. And for those who want a little dose of irony, he's a free-to-play developer. And for those of you who listened to the last few podcasts and me talking all this crap about how I hate free-to-play, he's an actual real-life free-to-play developer, and he's going to tell you about how he made his free-to-play development company. It's a great interview, and I hope you stick around for that right after this. Hey guys, you know this is the part of the show where I try to convince you to throw money at something. Usually it's one of my games or one of my friends' games, but it's not today. I want to get you to throw some money into a charity. And the charity I want you to throw money at is called Three Summits for Nepal. You can find them at threesummitsfornepal.com. You can also go find all the info in the info section of this podcast. Short version of what it is. It's a bunch of people up in Nepal. They're local Nepali folks that run a trekking company. And in the off season, when they don't have any treks to run, they use a bunch of local porters and local guides to carry concrete and rebar and aluminum siding and stuff like that up into the hills. And they build schools for underprivileged folks that live in the hills in the Himalayas. It's a great charity. It's run by local people. I know the guy who runs the charity personally. He's a good friend of mine. I've been involved with it for years. I've personally been up to Nepal a couple times and seen the work that they do. It's good work. Schools are getting built. Kids are getting educated. It's about as local grassroots a charity as you can get in that region, and I'm highly supportive of it. If anyone wants to know any more about it, I did a whole podcast where I interviewed Jawant about the charity and all that. You can check that out in my list of podcasts. You can also check out the website. Again, it's threesummitsfornepal.com. So check that out, and now we're going to get to the interview on the other side of this. All right, and we are back, and today we are talking to Edward Lee, who was born in Hong Kong, raised in Canada, and now he's in Hong Kong. He's the co-founder and CEO of Twitchy Finger, which is a game studio. He's also the managing director and producer at Mana Sound Studio, also in Hong Kong. He's proud of a lot of things in his life, but in the last few years, he's been building this mobile gaming company, and I wanted to talk to him about this process, building a studio, and, well, that's where we are. Hi, mm-hmm. Edward, how you doing?
Hi, Chris. I'm very honored to be on this podcast, and hi, everyone.
So I want to jump right into some sort of broad questions. We've been mm-hmm. doing kind of a tour through Southeast Asia, and we've had people from Indonesia and the Philippines and all these other great places talking about games in their region, and we haven't mm-hmm. had anyone from Hong Kong yet. So I want you to tell me
what do I need
to know about Hong Kong? What's the big broad strokes for understanding the game market in Hong Kong?
Well, first of all, I think for those who have not been in Hong Kong, it's although it's part of China, it's a independent governed state, I guess, city. Mm-hmm. So it used to be an ex-British colony. So there's it's like a melting pot between the East and the West. So for the game companies here, you're looking at, you know, there are local game companies and they're, you know, game companies, the founders are from all over the world. So you got this nice mixture of both, like Hong Kong itself, very East and West cultures all combined together.
So, I mean, when I'm looking at the games, you know, if I go to China and I look at games in China, I kind of mm-hmm. know what Chinese games look like.
Yeah.
Do Hong Kong games look like Chinese games? Do they look like Taiwanese games? What does a game look like in what's popular in the world of mm-hmm. games in Hong Kong?
Well, if you look at like App Annie, this analytics platform that yeah. shows the top, you know, grossing or top downloaded game in China. Mainly you look at like MMORPGs, some puzzle game, but mainly RPG games. For Taiwan, similar as well. But in Hong Kong, it's like a mixed bag. So you got these, you know, westernized games like, you know, Clash Royale. And then you got all these like, for paid games, you got games like what's that puzzle game with really nice art? Suddenly,
there's like a thousand, maybe like a thousand yeah. games. What's that puzzle game with the good art? Oh yeah, that one.
I just had it in my phone. Anyways, I put my phone away. So they have this mixture of like these very Chinese Asian style games, but they also, you know, they're really into the casual, more westernized games as well. So you got a mixture of both. Since, you know, the crowd here, you know, some of them are expats and there's a lot of like overseas people like, you know, came back to Hong Kong, you know, such as myself.
So tell me about language. I mean, because Hong Kong is this like way, you know, there's all kinds of different language things going on there. Obviously, because it's part of China now, there's Mandarin. Because yeah. it's Hong Kong, there's Cantonese. and obviously because of the British, you know, background, there's English. What language are people playing games in?
It's either in Chinese or in English. So it works either way. And the default language here in Hong Kong is Cantonese and English. So, you know, anyone knows English.
But I mean, if I'm doing voiceovers in a game that I'm putting in Hong Kong, I'm doing that in Cantonese, I'm not doing that in Mandarin?
That's the localization thing. So mainly in Hong Kong, people speak a dialect of, you know, Chinese is the overall arcing umbrella term. So within Chinese, there's different dialects, and Mandarin is the prevalent one right now, the official language of China. In Hong Kong, mainly most people speak Cantonese. It's a regional dialect. So for most people who want to play some localized games or games that are made in Hong Kong, if they're doing voiceovers, they would prefer in local Cantonese, but English is just as fine.
So tell me about platforms. What are they playing on in Hong Kong? Is it PC? Is it Steam? Is it iOS? Is it Android? What are people playing?
Well, if you're talking about like consoles, you know, the main ones are PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and then PC. You know, Steam's a big market in Hong Kong as well. A lot of people play Steam games. As for mobile, it's mainly iOS and Android, you know, just like the rest of the world.
But I mean, because if you look at different markets, some are like, no, we don't really do a lot of iOS here. It's all Android. Mm-hmm. Like if I go down the deep Southeast Asia, nobody's got an iPhone in Indonesia. It's all Android. But if I go to the States or even in Japan, it's very heavily iOS. What's Hong Kong?
I think it's a pretty even split. So, because Hong Kong does have one of the highest ARPUs in the world.
Yeah.
So iOS is a big thing. I think most people I know use iOS, but you know, it's a mixture. It's pretty much half and half, I think.
So for those who don't know ARPU, that's average revenue per user. So what we're saying is a user in Hong Kong, you know, if I get 10 users in Hong Kong, those users are going to give me more money than say 10 users in Indonesia or the Philippines.
Yep.
How many users are we talking about? How big is the market in Hong Kong?
Well, in Hong Kong, there's currently around 7.2 million people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, and basically, you're talking about everyone has a smartphone now, you know, except you know, really elderly people. But everyone has a smartphone. It's not their first smartphone. It's probably their fifth or fourth smartphone, because in Hong Kong, you know, people are very fickle. They love the newest and the trendiest things. So every new iPhone or Samsung Galaxy S8 or whatever, any type of new phone that comes out, you know, they have it. So
Hong Kong is where I buy all my phones. I make a point of when I go through Hong Kong, I always buy my phone there because the rest of the world doesn't know this. There's a law in Hong Kong that you can't lock phones in Hong Kong.
Yeah. And so, it's also I think it's the biggest gray market. For smartphones, yeah, because before when China didn't have iPhone yet, like they didn't have the Apple Store, that's where all the mainland Chinese people get their iPhones directly shipped from Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's like Hong Kong is like the shopping mall of Asia. Like it's where everybody's like, I'm gonna go do a big shopping trip in Hong Kong. I'm gonna buy my electronics. I'm gonna buy my brand name stuff and bring it home. Japanese people do that. Singaporeans do that.
It's a tax-free port, so you know you can bring anything in. We won't tax you. You can buy anything when you leave. We won't tax you either. So it's all good to go.
So why is this market important? I mean, it's 7 million people, which that's a lot of people, and it's 7 million, you know, well-heeled, technically competent. You know, 7 million people that matter to the world of mobile games, et cetera. But I think Hong Kong has sort of a larger role in Asia than just those 7 million people. It's my feeling that it's almost like a trend leading part of Asia.
Well, partly it's because Hong Kong has a very strong financial background. It's one of the, you know, main financial centers of the world. So, and it's also one of the big international hubs. So it's been, you know, ever since the economic boom of the 70s and 80s, you're talking about a lot of the, you know, the financial, you know, trends, and also the real estate market, you know, it leads in, you know, it's one of the most expensive places to live in the world right now. I think it's ranked number one in cost for living. So people do have a very strong association with, you know, the trend and what's new, the latest and greatest. So, you know, there's not, at this point, technology-wise, they don't lead in anything, but they, in terms of using it, you know, a usage, and actual purchasing power, Hong Kong has, you know, very high quality of standard for living.
I think it's also, I mean, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me Hong Kong is also sort of a culturally leading place in the Chinese speaking world. That a lot of style is set there, a lot of trends are set there.
Yeah, because traditionally, before mainland China was open to the West, all the entertainment and media, a lot of them came from Hong Kong. So like the TV shows, the movies, pop songs, a lot of the cultural stuff comes from Hong Kong. So even up to now, you'll see that most of the big stars that are making movies in China are all Hong Kong, locally, you know, local stars that became big. Even like Donnie Yen, you know, Star Wars, mm-hmm. Rogue One.
Yeah.
So he's a big Hong Kong film star. So, you know, in that terms, you know, entertainment-wise, they still lead in Asia.
But in right many now, ways, it's almost like the Los Angeles of Asia in a lot of ways.
Well, back then, I guess in the 80s and 90s. Now, I think that we're losing a lot of ground to Koreans.
That's absolutely true, actually. Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit. So that's Hong Kong. Let's talk about your role in Hong Kong. And I want to start talking about Twitchy Finger, which mm-hmm. is your game studio. And I want to just get the quick background on where you guys – a lot of people who are listening to this are entrepreneurs, and they want that entrepreneurial mm-hmm. story. How did you get started? How did you get funded? How did you get the place built? Tell me the story of Twitchy Finger.
Sure. I'll try to give it in 3 minutes or less. You
know. Done.
Basically, we started this company in 2014. It's me and two other founders. And I wasn't in the gaming background before. I was actually in entertainment background. And it's not my first company. I have another company that does post-production and media marketing and production. So I've started out doing a lot of music work for films, commercials, and such. And then my current partner, he used to work for one of the big game companies in Hong Kong. And as you know, like the music industry is kind of – it's not as good as before because no one buys music anymore. So you know, I kind of transitioned from, you know, making music as a music producer for pop songs and moved on to the more commercial films, you know, and such. And then I guess 3 or 4 years ago, I realized there's a market for, you know, mobile gaming music. And then that's when me and my partner, who was my friend before, you know, we used to go to the same school. I was asking him, like, how's like the whole mobile game market? He's like, oh, it's like booming right now. And then he actually outsourced some of the music for my studio to do. And eventually I was looking at it. Because I didn't play mobile games before, and then that's when I start looking at like Candy Crush, Clash of Clans, and then I'm like, oh my goodness, like people would pay 99 cents just for like 3 extra moves or like some gems, but they won't pay like 99 cents for an iTunes song, which is like what we do. We spend like months making a song and no one like. No,
it's infuriating. It's absolutely infuriating.
Exactly. But then, you know, out of that, you know, I see there's an opportunity there. So I was looking, hey, can we actually do something like this with a small budget and a small team? And after I guess months of like preparation, just doing research, and we found that, you know, I think we can do it in Hong Kong. And that's when we started Twitchy Finger.
So, I mean, it seems sure, we talked about Hong Kong, and it's a culturally leading place, and it's got lots of talent and whatnot. Seems like an expensive place to run a studio from.
It is. It's very expensive. Rent is just off the charts. And, you know, I was lucky because I didn't start from scratch. You know, I already started a company and we already have an established studio and office. So basically what we did was we combined the two, you know, game studio and the music studio together into one office. And then mm-hmm. we've been working out of there instead.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've heard horror stories about the rent there and the kind of spaces that people live in, the places that people work. I mean, what's your office like? Is it like one of these little places I see on the internet that's all tiny and everyone's crammed in the little tiny desks? And
Tiny is a very relative term, I guess. Like, in North America, tiny would be like, I don't know, like 700 square foot is like tiny or 600 square foot. But, like, in Hong Kong, that's a pretty sizable office. So our studio right now is our studio side is 700 square foot, 600 ish. Mm-hmm. So, and then our other side, which is the music studio part, it's also another like 600 square foot. So around combined around like 1400.
So how many people is this? How many people you got crammed into that?
For our games company, we have 6 people right now, including myself. Mm-hmm. So we're still relatively lean.
No, and that's the way to be. I mean,
that's the way to do it.
It's so funny. I talk to so many people, and I remember when BoomZap got quite large, people would be like, wow, you must be really happy. And I'm like, you don't understand this at all, do you? Like, I am not at all excited about having a big studio. I would love to be making this revenue with a lot less people. That would be better. Speaking of that, I want to turn to your games, right? Mm-hmm. And I want you to kind of give me just a rundown of the games that you put together and which ones for you have been really successful, and kind of run me through what you guys have done as a game studio.
Sure. As I've spoken before, we started early 2014. Yeah. Back then, we didn't have a full team. We only had like 3 people, just the founders. Mm-hmm. And then we got other people to come on. Eventually, we grew to 6 people. But in 2014, we only had like 4 people. So we couldn't do like a full scale, you know, those hard to mid core games. So we did a very casual running game. And it's called Furball Rampage. It's actually available on Android. It's not out on iOS, but it's on Android.
It's really so, cute too.
Yeah, it's a more American style, I guess, a more Disney-ish type of style of a running game. So we did that mainly to test out the team to see if we can actually, you know, it's one thing to work for a big company. It's different to, you know, come out and start your own small indie label and, you know, make a game from scratch and market it yourself. So what we did was we wanted to stick with something that's simple. We can do it in like, you know, within 4 to 5 months. So, you know, we set that goal out and see how much we can get, how much, you know, revenue and stuff. So that was a test bed for our entire company. And we launched the game in around July in 2014. It did decent. We did an Indiegogo campaign and we raised some funds for that. And we made back all, you know, all the money we spent on making the game. And that's when we realized, hey, you know, this might work. So let's start something that's a little bit more, you know, in-app purchase heavy, more mid-core game.
So before we move on to the next game, yeah. I wanna talk just a bit about that Indiegogo campaign you did. Because, I mean, this is something that a lot of entrepreneurs in the game industry are really interested in, is crowdfunding. How was that experience for you?
Back then, I guess crowdfunding still worked for, like, gaming. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't suggest that. Most people who do crowdfunding for mobile games especially, it's very hard. Because to most people, you know, a game's free anyways, right? So why am I giving you money for it?
It's hard enough to get them to pay for it, to get them to pay in advance for a mobile game.
Exactly. And the thing is, they often know that like it's free and you guys gonna have IAP anyways in app purchases. So I don't think I should fund this. Another mentality is like what I get back. Usually because it's a digital game, there's nothing in return. So what you do is you gotta have all these perks, you know, for your backers, you know, whether it be T-shirts or physical products, which often adds to the overhead of your campaign. So I would definitely not advise to use any of the crowdfunding for your games, unless, you know, for the full production, unless you know that you can complete it. Say I'm already like 80% complete and I just need, you know, like $3,000, $5,000 more to finish this, then I guess you can attempt to do it. But if you're saying like I'm starting a whole project from scratch and I need this full amount of funding, like say like $10,000 to fully fund this or else it won't work, I wouldn't suggest it because the partly is very hard to get funding. Second of all, it's very time consuming to run a crowdfunding platform. Yeah, the marketing, because it's so big now, like even the big name publishers do it now, like Sega does it. You know, you got all these big, you know, companies that are going on to this crowdfunding platform. So it's very hard to stand out. And also, you got to engage your users, you know, often, engage your backers and try to build word of mouth or, you know, viral marketing, whatever. It's very time consuming. And often for something that's not a physical product, say if you're making like a watch or if you're making some type of new coffee machine, you know, definitely look towards crowdfunding. I think it definitely works. But if you're doing like a digital game, even a Steam game, it would be quite hard to do, I think.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I one thing that I hear a lot, if you go, you know, look at the Reddits and whatnot, and you hear a lot of people, I hear the same question a lot, which is, does the crowdfunding campaign increase my marketing? I don't really need the money, but I just want to do it for the marketing. You used Indiegogo. Did your Indiegogo campaign work for you as a marketing vehicle, or did you end up spending more time marketing the campaign? And I mean, did it feel like it really improved your marketing at all?
I guess it helped somewhat to get the noise out. I guess some you know, media outlets did pick up on the story, did review a little bit on it. But it's more of the game itself than rather the fun, because we did have this little gimmick in the game. You know, it's about this hamster that eats like a certain radioactive seed, that Godzilla type of thing. And then, you know, some people found that funny, you know, and they found it comical. So they, you know, they reported the aspect of that. But in terms of like, does it help when your game launches, does it, you know, does it increase downloads? I don't think it really does in particular. So, you know, we raised enough so that we could do some, help us do some marketing afterwards. But in terms of actual, you know, is it a big help? I don't think it's a learning experience. We learned a lot from it, but like any, you know, material type of, you know, benefit, it's not that much.
All right, so I stopped you before on continuing on your next game. Now let's continue on. So you've done Furball. What happens after that?
So we find that, you know, a casual game, it's quite hard to do during that, you know, back in 2014, because mm-hmm. you need the mass amount of downloads. So we went, you know, the opposite spectrum. We're like, okay, we can execute. So we know that we can execute a game from start to finish within a reasonable time. Let's do something a little bit deeper and something that can help us get more revenue, because, you know, up to even now, we're still fully, you know, self-funded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we went with a game that was a little bit more mid-core. So picking the topic was the hard part. You know, what type of game can a six-person, you know, indie studio do? You know, we can't touch anything. You know, basically, we know that if we aim for something big, like a puzzle game, or you know, a game that's like Clash of Clans, it'll be very hard to do because we don't have the manpower, we don't have the marketing budget, and you're just going up against all the big boys. So what we do is we find a very niche topic with a very dedicated core group of users, and then we just made a game based on that. And the topic we ended up was this toy that was very popular in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s. It's called the Mini 4WD. So it's one of the big, it's like a model car, but it's not a slot car, and it's not a radio control car. It's a car that has a basic motor, batteries, and some gears. And once you can tune on the wheels, you know, the front bumpers and stuff, and it runs on a set track. So those are very popular in Asia, especially if you're in Southeast Asia or in Japan. Everyone's played these, you know, if you grew up in the 80s and the 90s. So, and up to that point, there was still no game that was made based on that type of topic. So we picked, you know, Mini 4WD as a racing genre topic, and then we build a game upon
just that. For the record, I had never heard of this before. I was doing some research, I was looking at the game, yeah. And I was like, I've never seen that. Because I thought, when I first saw it, I thought slot cars, this looks like slot cars, but it's not slot cars, it's something else.
It's like Japanese slot cars. So the big company that made it, made the big waves in that segment was Tamiya. So that's one of the big model companies that makes like model toys, cars mm-hmm. and stuff. So they never using that Mini 4WD genre. So we took that and then we built our own game on that. And then ended up, it was a big hit. So we have 3.4 million downloads right now.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's decent, you know, for such a niche topic. So that helped a lot. Like, I guess like most of your listeners are, you know, maybe like indie developers or people who
quite a few of them
trying,
are, yes.
Yeah. So I would suggest, you know, it worked for us. It doesn't mean it will work for everyone, but like it worked for us. You know, try to find like a niche topic that, you know, the big companies don't really touch, because, you know, 3.5 million downloads isn't a lot for the big companies, mm-hmm. you know, but it's, you know, but it's a lot for a small company like ourselves. And, you know, just find something that, do some research, find something that is popular or was popular, and no one really touched upon it, and then build a game on that.
So, you know? I want to go a little deeper into that, because you're not the first person who suggested this to me, and it's a really nice strategy. So how did you reach out and let those people who are into that thing know that you'd made something for them? What was your marketing effort? How did you push this to them and let them know that this thing was there?
Well, you know, right now you got Facebook and you got all these social media pages and discussion forums that are dedicated to these hobbyists, right? So like if you're like a Mini 4WD builder or a player and you love playing these model cars, most of you would join these, you know, Facebook pages or like Reddits or whatever that are dedicated to this, you know, this digital, you know, this toy. So what we do is we just go on all these forums and Facebook page, and then we promote the game through that.
I mean, did you buy ads on those sites, or did you like go in as a user and like be part of the community? How did you, tell me, go deeper into how you did that.
So basically, we started with like zero budget. We don't have any money to do any marketing. Mm-hmm. So one of the first thing we did was we started our own page on Facebook, And then we posted a lot on the topic itself, not the game, but just the topic. We post like all these cards that were popular, you know, all these tips and all these other things. Mm. We joined a lot of the pages as users to, you know, to get involved and, you know, see what people like and do research and, you know, how much interest is still in, you know, Mini 4WD. So we found that there's quite a lot of people that are interested in it. And you know, during that time, there was like a renaissance of that. And a lot of people who grew up, you know, in their, you know, late 20s now, or early 30s, you know, they really like playing that as a kid. But now they don't have the time to do it. And a lot of them are just lamenting, like, oh, I love these toys. You know, they would buy the toy, but they don't have the time to race it, or they don't have the space to buy the tracks. So, you know, to them, it's something nostalgic. It was, you know, we participated in a lot of discussions with a lot of these social media pages and groups. And they end up, as we're nearing completion, we started dropping hints. We're like, oh, you know, there's this game coming up that's like going to be based on this toy. And they're like, you know, instantly, you know, there's a lot of feedback. It's like, oh, that sounds awesome. You know, it was like, tell me more. I'm like, oh, there's a page on Facebook, you know, called Mini Legend. And this is the game that's coming up. So a lot of people went and checked out that page and liked it and kept following, you know, the status of the production.
But it sounds like to get to that point, though, it wasn't just that you went to those groups and just dropped something in their forums. Hey, we made this thing. There was a long process before that of sort of getting to be part of that community. And
It's okay, because like I used to play these cards when I was little, so I knew about the topic itself. Mm. So it's just like once in a while I'd post something, you know, some old cards that I used to have. And, you know, just join in. It's not super active. Like maybe I go on, like, you know, I check it out, you know, once or twice a week and then just see what people post. And then after we had some screenshots of the new game, I just posted it. And then, you know, it wasn't, because, you know, it's still related to the topic. So people were very open-minded about it. You know, it wasn't like I was plugging anything. Another thing was, I guess there's a big thirst for a game that's based on this genre, on this topic. So when we put it out, you know, there wasn't a lot of resistance, you know, and there's a lot of support for it. So that's phase one, I guess. And that's when we start picking up all these Facebook likes on our page. And then that's one way of marketing. And then what we did after was just like try to, once we build enough likes on the page, we start asking people to share or, you know, comment on the post. And that got word out further. And then the second step was actually contacting some of the local, you know, media outlets or like websites that cover, you know, hobbies or even like video games. So we're fortunate to find enough resources. We didn't have money, so we basically just told them, you know, we're making this game. It's based on this 90s toy. And, you know, what do you think? And then, you know, some of the media outlets thought, hey, that's cool. You know, like I remember playing these when I was little. It's like, that's actually pretty cool. Like, I haven't seen a game that's like that out there. So sure, we can, you know, we can write a blurb or, you know, an article on it. And that's how we, you know, started picking up steam.
I guess one of the nice things there, it sounds like, is, you know, if you're just making, you know, another game that's just another computer game that's got, you know, orcs or goblins or, you know, space marines or something like that in it, then the only real option you have is to go to the game sites, and the game sites get 1,000 emails a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But you had the option of going to these sort of specialist hobby forums, these specialist hobby medias, and saying, hey, you know, a fan magazine that deals with this very specialized topic, we have a game for your specialized topic, which is a very different way of looking at it than, hey, game site, we have a game for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's more like, you know, establishing a rapport first. Like, oh, did you ever play like Mini 4WD? And I guess if you're in Southeast Asia or in Asia in general, and if you're, you know, a kid that grew up in the 80s, for sure you've played this before. It's like it's like playing with Legos or Hot Wheels. Mm-hmm. So it's the equivalent of Hot Wheels in US. So everyone has a Hot Wheel sometime in their life, right? Or at least know about it. So
I have a lot of Hot Wheels.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that a lot of people have fond memories of Mini 4WD. So, you know, that was our way into the door. And then that's when we start pitching more about our game. And then what else we did was, you know, we attended a lot of the game conferences, like Casual Connect. I think that's where I met you, Chris, the first time.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So, Casual Connect, if you guys don't know, it's like a global indie, competition/showcase for, you know, indie gamers. So they hold it in different cities every year. And the one I went to was in Singapore. And there's actually a Casual Connect next month from the 16th to 18th of May. So that's where a lot of the indie developers...
In Singapore, I should mention.
In Singapore, so
the,
yes.
They do it actually in a number of cities.
Yeah.
They're doing Singapore next May. I don't know if you know this. Next year, it's Hong Kong.
Yep, I know. So. Yeah. I was in contact with the promoter. Not the promoter. I mean the sponsor, mm-hmm. Animal Cook Group. So they're mm-hmm. sponsoring it next year in Hong Kong. So, you know, we showcased our game in Casual Connect, and it caught the attention of Apple. So, you know, it's a funny story. You know, when you display all these games in conferences, you never know who approaches you, right? It could be a developer, it could be a press, it could be just like normal gamers, you know, just want to check out the. What happened was we were demoing Furball Rampage, our first game, 2 years ago. In Casual Connect Singapore. And then, you know, I was just demoing it normal, you know, running through the paces. And there's this person that checked out a game and thought, hey, this game looks really neat. You know, I haven't seen this before. You know, a little cute hamster that turns into this like monster that starts eating people and like pushing down buildings. That sounds pretty neat. And then she asked me like, have you guys tried, you know, sending it to Apple for featuring? And then, you know, we just started out. So we're like, I don't even have an email from Apple. You know, I don't know who to contact. And end up, you know, she's like, oh, you can contact me. I'm like, I'm from Apple. And then my eyes instantly just went, whoa. I was like, oh, my God, I need to nail this. So I pitched her, you know, talked to her about how awesome the game is. And then she's like, this sounds amazing. How about, you know, I contact you again. And then by then I was like, can I get your card? And then Apple... The rep was like, oh, we don't give cards. We don't.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're real. They're harsh like that.
Yes, they're harsh. I'm like, oh, I'm like, ouch. But it's like, it's okay. I have your card, so I'll contact you. And then fast forward like several weeks later, she actually did email me for a meeting. And then she was in Hong Kong. So I went to Apple headquarters in Hong Kong. And then we did the meeting. But by then, I already had Mini Legend in beta, in an early alpha beta-ish stage. So, you know, I don't know how many shots I have at, you know, featuring. So we're like, so I kind of upsold her mm-hmm. from Furball Rampage to Mini Legends, saying, you know, this is the game to feature because this is one of a kind game. It's like huge back in the 80s and 90s, and just told the whole story about how, like, you know, we grew up playing these model cars, huge memories, fond memories of it. You know, now that, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, like, you know, we don't have time for any of these. You know, I still buy the toy, but, like, we just don't have time to play. And it'll be awesome. That's why we wanted to build this game, so that we can still play with, you know, this type of in the digital form and still get, you know, the memories from playing the real thing. So, you know, we pitched back and forth, and eventually they agreed to feature us. So that was really awesome. Well, they never agree. Apple never agreed. If
you no, you don't know until
you don't know. You don't know.
They're like,
so
why don't you give us all the materials we need for the feature, and we'll see. And then like the and this is what people don't know. You don't know that you've been featured until
you don't know.
You open up your iPhone and you're featured, and that's how you know. They don't even send you a letter to be like, you're gonna be featured today. You just oh, look, we got featured. Like
yes. That's exactly how it is. Yeah. So the featuring process, I can break that down. Basically, if like they like your game enough, you don't have to have meetings with them. It just so happened that we you know, it's just pure coincidence that they found us. So your game and they want to feature you, they usually send you an email saying that, you know, your game has been selected, nominated for featuring. Could you send us the artwork? You know, it's a banner, you know, whatever. And you're going to send in the artwork. Submit it through the you know, the Apple iTunes Connect. Mm-hmm. And then even then it says there's like, it does not guarantee feature. So, and then they won't tell you time.
Nope.
But they usually give you a deadline of when you got to submit everything. So, you know, when we got that email, we thought like, hey, this sounds pretty legit by now. So, but we still don't know. And then that's not when we launched our game. The first day it didn't get featured. I think the second day it didn't get featured, but on the third day, that's when the feature came in, and you know, we were like super happy. Like, I guess as a developer, like getting featured by either Apple or Google is like the best thing in the world.
You know, the thing is, it's moved from being that's the best thing in the world to being not getting featured is like the call of death. Like that's where it's really moved to, like, if you didn't get featured on Apple or Google, pray real hard, because it's just really difficult to get anyone to know that you exist without that feature. And that feature is, it's exactly like you say, it's like, there's no guarantee, there's no nothing, you just, you know, and you just kind of give them the stuff and you pray, you know, and it's not like a, oh, I know a guy. And it's so, that's the worst part, is like publishers will tell you this bullshit story and they'll be like, oh, we can get you featured. No, they can't. There's no publisher in the world that can guarantee you a feature, because nobody does that but Apple and Google, and they make that decision independent of anyone but themselves.
Yep.
Nobody doesn't matter what they promise you, they can't get you featured. That's up to them.
I can tell you, basically the big publishers, they can guarantee it. But it is easier for them. It is easier. Like, I've seen some big publishers that release games. You know, you look at it, it's just, it's really mediocre. But
what I will say is, some of the I think the publishers can guarantee you that the feature team will look at your game.
Yeah.
I think that's the guarantee
they can
give you.
I think that's the guarantee. Yeah.
We can make sure that the people who decide whether or not games get featured will look at your game. But beyond that, like, nobody can make you any promises. Mm-hmm. And I've heard so many people sign crappy publishing deals because their publisher swore to them that they'd get featured. And the other thing about a feature is not a feature, right? There's a worldwide feature, there's a nationwide feature, there's a regional feature, there's, you know, there's sometimes you only get featured in one category, and some of those features are a lot better than other features, right?
Yeah, so basically, if you're looking at Apple, there's basically three types of feature. So one's the biggest banner, which is like when you open the App Store, it's right on the top banners, the huge one. That's like the holy grail.
Yep.
You know, that's the one that usually goes global. And then the second one, it's a smaller banner. That's still really good. That's still, I think we never got featured, but we got the smaller banner. So that's really good already. And then the third type of feature is just the icon. It's just your icon, your game icon. And usually those are for, like, you know, if you had a really nice update or you have some new you know, you've been featured before and they feature again, they usually put you in the icons.
Yeah.
And then, in different categories. As for Google Play, Google Play has different segments. Like, it's even more broken down.
Yep.
So, you know, you could be featured on the main screen for the apps. You could be featured like a big banner, or you can feature it as an icon, or even you can be featured in specialty segments like Indie Corner, or, you know, and such. So it depends.
And all of these are broken down by region, right? So you may get the big banner feature in China, but I'm not China, but you may get the big banner feature in Japan, but you don't get the big banner feature in the UK, et cetera. So there's a lot of ways that this gets sliced.
So when you do have a chance to, you know, Apple or Google regarding feature, or you have a way of, you know, pitching to them, you know, try to always go for the global. And then at the same time, besides global, also focus on your main market that you're aiming your game at. So if your game looks very westernized, you know, go for the western regions first, you know, before you start pitching to the Asian regions. Or if your game looks very Asian-y, now it's hard, you know, hard for the U.S. editorials to look at your game and go, oh, this suits the U.S., you know, environment. Yeah. Region, you know, just try to, you know, sell to the people that would actually look at it, and besides looking at it, have a higher chance of actually featuring you.
Going back a couple minutes in the conversation, though, I think there was another really great lesson for young indie developers to take out of this, which is never assume who you're talking to. You know, this whole story started with you were talking to someone and you didn't know who they were and you were showing them their game. And lo and behold, this was somebody on the Apple feature committee. And you didn't know that when you started showing them the game, right?
So, like, just be friendly and just, you know, if someone wants to check out your game, it's amazing in itself, because, like, you attend these game conferences and there's literally like hundreds of games on the show floor. So anyone that wants to, you know, spend time, stop by and actually look at your game, it's a great way to share, you know, your product. And, you know, you should be happy and you should be grateful that they're looking at your game. Because I go to some of these conferences and some people, you know, they just put the game, like some pamphlets and then just leave. And then, you know, what's the point?
Or even worse, I've gone to some of these conferences and you walk up and you're like, can I play your game? And they're like, yeah, whatever. And they're like busy answering mail on Facebook, and you're like, you're at a convention, show me your game, dude. You know, you don't know who I am. I could be the Apple person, and you're blowing me off because you got to, you know, look at some cat pictures on Facebook. You're here for a reason, dude.
So like, what I would suggest is that I know for like a lot of the small teams, you know, you talk about maybe 2-3 man teams. Mm-hmm. If you have a conference to attend and you already have a booth, I know it's very hard for, you know, for you to like look after the booth and reply to your daily task. So I would suggest if you ever have a booth, get at least 2 people, or you know, try to get your whole team to attend, so you can always have one person that can always talk to everyone, and at least have two, you know, because you know if you're talking to one guy, another guy walks up and wants to look at your game, you have to, you know, either wait or you know, or you gotta, you know, have them check it out on their own. So the more people you have at the booth, actually, the better it is. You know,
actually had really good luck at the last few. We've been to the last couple PAX events. And the thing that we forget at those kind of events is, like, for us as developers, it's easy to get tickets to get into PAX. But for the audience, it's difficult to get PAX tickets.
It
and
is.
When we get a booth, they give us 5 free tickets. I don't have 5 people at PAX. And so I go on my community Discord for my games, and I'm like, I got free tickets to PAX to come work my booth. And so if you come to one of our booths at a show, there's me and then 4 volunteers that we brought in for free PAX tickets. And those guys are actually really committed. They're really into it. They're trying to be helpful. They're part of your game community. They're people that come from, you know, they're people who loved your game. And they actually tend to be really good people at booths. I've had really good luck with bringing volunteers, you know, but it's got to be someone who gives a crap about your game. But we've had people who are part of our gaming community that are into that, that when I said, hey, why don't you come down and I'll buy you dinner and I'll give you some free tickets to the show, they're happy to do it. And so we always have like 4 or 5 people in the booth, and that makes it, you know, a lot more energetic and active. It works pretty well.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool thing. I should try that next time.
It was not my idea. I totally stole that idea from Witching Hour, who are some of the best marketers down in Singapore, and they were doing that for their games, and I heard about them doing that, and I was like, I should totally do that. So I totally stole the idea. Okay. All right, I'm running low on time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get to my last question, which is, again, there's and even more so now that I've heard what we've talked about. This would be a great show for young indies to listen and get some great sort of actionable feedback. What are sort of your top 2 or 3, if you're going to go start a game studio, or if you're in a young game studio and you're struggling and you're trying to figure out how to make this all work, what's your best advice?
Okay, there's several things that you got to look into. First of all, you know, everyone who gets into the gaming industry loves games, right? So that's that's de facto. You don't need to care about that. What you need to care about is how you run a business. After all, it's a business. You know, if you're thinking, oh, I'm just going to make games for fun, you know, unless you don't expect to make any money, then don't do it. You know, if you want to make it this your livelihood, you got to look at the economics. You got to look at your financial stuff. Do you have money yourself? Do you have savings? If you don't, then you got to find a partner that has the money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have the knowledge, you have the you have the talent to do it, but you don't have the money, go out and find the money. All right. And if you have the money, but you don't have the people to do it, the talent, then go find the talent. You need both. So another thing you got to look at is keeping lean. You have to be lean. So whether that be working out from your house, from your apartment, or, you know, a co-working, you know, co-share workspace, or just, you know, whatever you can do, you know, out of back of a car or whatever. Whatever works, do it. Keep your overhead low as possible. Like, even to this point now, you know, we do well enough to sustain. But the thing is, we're very careful about hiring. So even growing our team, you know, don't grow too fast or too early. You know, try to establish a core team of people who are very, very dedicated, and they know what they're getting into. Because if you hire or if you partner with someone that don't know what they're getting into, they might quit like 4 months down the line because they don't see any results or whatever. You know, game is a long, you know, it's a long, arduous process. It's a grind. So if you don't know what you're getting into, or your partner doesn't know what they're getting into, you're going to have some problems down the line. So build that core team that knows what their product is, set a timeline. You have to hit those timelines. You know, the longer you spend, the more money you're burning. So once you have that, and you need to find a good topic, and one more thing, I know like not everyone buys into this, but if you're doing mobile, you know, free to play, I know it's not the most fun way of doing games, but it's what makes you alive. It keeps you alive. You know, whether it be in-app purchases or ad-based, you have to have monetization done very, very well. So what you can do is, like, if even if you're making a game for like the Western market, go look at some, you know, Chinese-based games or Asian-based games. They know how to market the crap out of the game. So once you have money, then you can focus on how to make it fun. You know, like our game, like it's a fun game, but inside we've done so many things within the monetization model that ensures that we make money from day one, so that we don't sit around and just look at, you know, we have like so many downloads, but we're not making jack. Okay. So you have to make money because it's a business in the end. So once you have that, then it's about how you maintain these financials and how you sustain. So as an indie, just don't die.
I have to interject. this is incredibly ironic because this interview is going to come right after like two podcasts that I did where I talk about how much I hate free to play. So the irony of at this point me having an interview and something like, what you need to do is free to play games. I'm not sure I'm willing to go with you 100% on it's got to be free to play, but I will go with you 100% on you have to think about how you're going to make money on this. You have to think about how your monetization works. And I think there are a number of different business models work with different kinds of games. Yeah. And I think you are absolutely right that one of the things I really see indies failing with, and I can remember I was at the last Casual Connect and I walked, this was the one in Berlin, and I went and I looked at a bunch of indie games, and I would say 80% of them, I just kind of looked at it and I said, how are you making money on this? Yeah. I mean, I just couldn't even figure out where does the money come in? Where do you expect somebody to pay for this? And I guess if you're into games as a hobby, they were great. But if you're into running a game studio, it's like you say, you got to start the whole process with where does the money come in on this thing? And whether it's a free-to-play model or a different model, you've got to have something there.
So I'm not pushing free to play, but I'm just saying like you got to have your monetization set. So if you're doing a paid game and you have a very, you know, not every game is suitable for free to play, right?
No.
So if your game is very story based or story driven or whatever, go with the paid model, but make sure that you have a way to monetize, you know, or what lures people to pay for your game. If you don't have it, then people are just going to bypass it. So, you know, in the end, you got to know that it's a business. You know, it's fun the first, you know, year or so, you know, when you're starting a game company, but then, you know, cost builds up quickly. And when you're not making a lot of money or you're making no money at all, or even on top of that, you're shelling out more and more money, it's not fun.
Yeah. So it's not fun once you start not being able to pay your rent.
Yeah.
It starts to get real, not fun real fast.
Yeah. So, you know, make sure the takeaway is just, you know, make sure you have a way to monetize your game. That's the biggest thing. And once you can monetize, you know, stick to a very lean overhead, you know, only spend on parts that you think it's worth it. So if you're spending on ads, make sure you have a tracking software that can track, you know, how much you're spending, the players that paid, you know, or, you know, the cost acquisition that you've done through the ads are, you know, those guys are giving you, you know, positive return on investment, you know, or else you just, you know, blindly throwing money away in marketing without any return. So make sure that you know where the money's going and you know that the money you spent comes back.
All right, well, that's all great info. That's all the time that we have. This is incredibly great stuff. I'm going to put this on a bunch of places where the indies hang out and say, like, look, here's a guy who knows how to do it. You want to run your indie studio? Here it is. So thank you so much for all of this great stuff. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
And that is it for the show today. I had a lot of fun live streaming putting this together. If you're interested in seeing me do that, I think I'm going to make that a thing because that was really fun. And it also kept me really like on task because like I had to do it straight on and not like go check my Facebook or anything while I was doing it. So that was awesome. If you're into this show and you want to support what we're doing, go check us out at the Discord. Tell me what you think. Leave notes. If you want more people to be here, you got to bring them. So go put us on your Twitters and your live feeds and your Facebooks and your whatevers, do all that thing, and we will see you here on the next show next week.